Pharaoh Tomoza saw the chariot returning, and knew by the impetuous manner in which Nadja drove that something untoward was afoot. Quietly, he ordered the squadron to mount up and stand with drawn weapons, ready to meet any eventuality. Nadja's chariot rattled up the pathway from the wadi bottom. The moment it drew level with where Pharaoh waited, he sprang down. "What's amiss?" Tomoza demanded. "A blessing from the gods," Nadja told him, unable to stop his voice shaking with excitement. "They've delivered our Pepe defenseless into our power."
"How's that possible?"
"My spies have led me to where the enemy king is encamped, but a short distance from where we now stand. His tents are set up just beyond the first line of hills yonder."
He pointed back with his drawn sword. "Can you be certain it's our Pepe?"
Tomoza could barely control his own excitement. "I saw him clearly in the light from his campfire. Every detail of his features, his great beak, nose and beard shot with silver, shining in the firelight. There's no mistaking such stature. He towers above all those round him, and he wears the vulture crown on his head."
"What's his strength?" Pharaoh demanded.
"With his usual arrogance, he has a bodyguard of less than 50. I've counted them, and half of them are asleep, their lances stacked. He suspects nothing, and his watchfires burn bright. A swift charge out of the darkness, and we'll have him in our grasp."
"Take me to where Apepi lies," Pharaoh commanded, and leapt to the footplate.
Nadja led them, and the soft, silvery sands of the wadi muffled the sound of the wheels, so that in a ghostly silence the squadron swept around the last bend, and Nadja raised his clenched fist high to order the halt. Pharaoh drew up alongside him and leant across.
"Where lies Apepi's camp?" "Beyond the ridge. I left my spies overlooking it."
Nadja pointed up the pathway towards the watchtower on the crest.
"On the far side is a hidden oasis, a sweet water well and date palms. His tents are set among the trees."
"We'll take a small patrol with us to scout the camp. Only then can we plan our attack."
Nadja had anticipated the order, and with a few terse orders selected a scouting party of 5 troopers. Each one was bound to him by blood oath. They were his men, hand and heart.
"Muffle your scabbards," Nadja ordered. "Make not a sound."
Then, with his recurved bow in his left hand, he stepped onto the pathway. Pharaoh came close behind him. They went upwards swiftly until Nadja saw the crossed branches of the thorn tree silhouetted against the dawn sky. He stopped abruptly, held up his right hand for silence.
He listened.
"What is it?"
Pharaoh whispered close behind him.
"I thought I heard voices on the crest," Nadja answered, "speaking the Hyksosian tongue. Wait here, Majesty, while I clear the path ahead."
Pharaoh and the 5 troopers sank down and squatted beside the path, while Nadja went on stealthily. He stepped round a large boulder, and his dim figure disappeared from view. The minutes passed slowly, and Pharaoh began to fret. The dawn was coming on swiftly. The Hyksosian king would soon be breaking his camp and moving on, out of their grasp. As a soft whistle came down to him, he sprang to his feet eagerly. It was a skilful imitation of a nightingale's dawn call. Pharaoh hefted his fabled blue sword.
"The way is clear," he murmured. "Come, follow me."
They went on upwards, and Pharaoh reached the tall rock that blocked the pathway. He stepped round it, then stopped abruptly. Lord Nadja faced him at a distance of 20 paces. They were alone, hidden by the rock from the men who followed. Nadja's bow was at full, and the arrow was aimed at Pharaoh's naked chest. Even before he could move, the full realization of what confronted him blazed in Pharaoh's mind. This was the foul and loathsome thing that Taita, with his clairvoyant powers, had smelt in the air. The light was strong enough for him to make out every detail of the enemy he had loved as a friend. The bowstring was pulled hard against Nadja's lips, twisting them into a dreadful smile, and his eyes were honey-gold and fierce as those of the hunting leopard as he glared at Pharaoh. The fletching of the arrow was crimson and yellow and green, and in the Hyksosian fashion the arrowhead was made from razor-sharp flint designed to tear through the bronze of an enemy's helmet and cuirass.
May you live for ever.
Silently, Narja mouthed the words as though they were a curse, and he loosed the arrow. It flew from the bowstring with a twang and a hum. It seemed to come quite slowly, like some poisonous flying insect. The feathers spun the shaft, and it made one full revolution as it covered the 20 paces. Though Pharaoh's eyesight was sharpened and his other senses were heightened by the mortal danger in which he found himself, he could move only with the slowness of a nightmare, too slowly to avoid the missile. The arrow took him high in the center of his chest, where his royal heart pounded in its cage of ribs. It struck with the sound of a boulder dropped from a height into a bed of thick Nile mud, and half the length of the shaft was driven through his chest. He was spun round by the force of the impact and thrown against the red rock of the boulder. For a moment he clung to the rough surface with his hooked fingers. The flint arrowhead had pierced him through and through. A blood-clotted barb stood out of the knotted muscles that ran down the right side of his spine. The blue sword dropped from his fist, and a low cry burst from his open mouth, the sound muffled by a gout of his own bright lung blood. He began to slide down to his knees, his legs buckling under him, his fingernails leaving shallow scratches on the red rock. Narja sprang forward with a wild cry, "Ambush! Beware!" And he slipped one arm round Pharaoh's chest below the protruding arrow. Supporting the dying king, he bellowed again, "On me, the guards!" And two stout troopers appeared almost instantly from around the rock wall, responding to his rallying cry. They saw at a glance how Pharaoh was struck, and the bright bunch of feathers on the base of the arrow. "Hyksos!" one yelled, and they snatched Pharaoh from Narja's grasp and dragged him back behind the shelter of the rock. "Carry Pharaoh back to his chariot while I hold off the enemy," Narja ordered, and whirled round, pulling another arrow from his quiver, and loosing it up the path towards the deserted summit, bellowing a challenge, then answering himself with a muffled counter-challenge in the Hyksosian language. He snatched up the blue sword from where Tamosa had dropped it, bounded back down the path, and caught up with the small party of charioteers who were carrying the king away, down to where the chariots were waiting in the wadi. "It was a trap," Narja told them urgently. "The hilltop is alive with the enemy. We must get Pharaoh away to safety." But he could see by the way the king's head rolled weakly on his shoulders that he was past any help, and Narja's chest swelled with triumph. The blue war crown toppled from Pharaoh's brow and bumped down the path. Narja gathered it up as he ran past, fighting down the temptation to place it on his own head. "Patience, the time is not yet ripe for that," he chided himself silently. "But already Egypt is mine, and all her crowns and pomp and power. I am become this very Egypt. I am become part of the Godhead." He held the heavy crown protectively under his arm, and aloud he cried, "Hurry! The enemy's on the path hard behind us! Hurry! The king must not fall into their hands!" The troops below had heard the wild cries in the dawn, and the regimental surgeon was waiting for them beside the wheel of Pharaoh's chariot. He had been trained by Taita, and though lacking the old man's special magic, he was a skilled doctor and might be capable of staunching even such a terrible wound as had pierced Pharaoh's chest. But Lord Narja would not risk having his victim returned to him from the underworld. He ordered the surgeon away brusquely. "The enemy is hard upon us. There's no time for your quackery now. We must get him back to the safety of our own lines before we're overrun." Tenderly, he lifted the king from the arms of the men who carried him and laid him on the footplate of his own chariot. He snapped off the shaft of the arrow that protruded from the king's chest and held it aloft so all his men could see it clearly. "This bloody instrument has struck down our pharaoh, our god, and our king. May Seth damn the Hyksosian pig swine who fired it, and may he burn in eternal flame for 1,000 years. His men growled in warlike agreement. Carefully, Narja wrapped the arrow in a linen cloth and placed it in the bin on the side wall of the chariot. He would deliver it to the council in Thebes to substantiate his report on Pharaoh's death. "A good man here to hold Pharaoh," Narja ordered. treat him gently. While the king's own lance-bearer came forward, Narja unbuckled the sword-belt from around Pharaoh's waist, sheathed the blue sword, and carefully stowed it in his own weapons bin. The lance-bearer jumped up onto the footplate and cradled Tamosa's head. Fresh, bright blood bubbled from the corners of his mouth as the chariot wheeled in a circle and then sped back up the dry wadi with the rest of the squadron driving hard to keep up with it. Even though he was supported by the strong arms of his lance-bearer, Pharaoh's limp body was jolted cruelly. Facing forward so that none could see his expression, Narja laughed softly. The sound was covered by the grinding wheels and the crash of the chassis over the small boulders he made no attempt to avoid. They left the wadi and raced on towards the dunes and the Natron lakes. It was mid-morning and the blinding white sun was halfway up the sky before Narja allowed the column to halt and the surgeon to come forward again to examine the king. It did not need his special skills to tell that Pharaoh's spirit had long before left his body and started on its journey to the underworld. "Pharaoh is dead," the surgeon said quietly as he stood up with the royal blood coating his hands to the wrists. A terrible cry of mourning started at the head of the column and ran down its entire length. Narja let them play out their grief, then sent for his troop captains. "The state is without a head," he told them. "Egypt is in dire peril. 10 of the fastest chariots must take the pharaoh's body back to Thebes with all haste. I shall lead them, for it may be that the council will wish me to take up the duties of regent to Prince Nefer." He had planted the first seeds, and saw by their awed expressions that they'd taken root almost immediately. He went on with a grim businesslike air that suited the tragic circumstances which had overtaken them. "The surgeon must wrap the royal corpse before I take it home to the funeral temple. But in the meantime we must find Prince Nefer. He must be informed of his father's death and of his own succession. This is the single most urgent matter of state and of my regency." He had assumed that title smoothly, and no man questioned him or even looked askance. He unrolled a papyrus scroll, a map of the territory from Thebes down to Memphis, and spread it on the dashboard of his chariot. He pored over it. "You must split up into your troops and scour the countryside for the prince. I believe that Pharaoh sent him into the desert with the eunuch to undertake the rituals of manhood, so we'll concentrate our search there, from Galala, where we last saw him, towards the south and east." With the eye for ground of a commander of armies, Narja picked out the search area and ordered a net of chariots to be spread out across the land to bring in the prince.